Welcome to Design Downtime, the podcast where we celebrate the joys of living a balanced creative life. I'm your host, Guy Siegel, a design director in Toronto, Canada, and I invite you to join me on this journey as we redefine what it means to be a successful design professional. Let's break free from the shackles of hustle culture and embrace the full spectrum of human experience, because life is too precious to be spent only in pursuit of productivity. Today, I'm excited to talk to Homer Gaines. Homer is a designer, UI engineer, and certified accessibility professional with over 30 years of experience. With a background in behavioral psychology and neurology, he focuses on leading, promoting, and advancing accessibility at every stage in the product development lifecycle. Homer, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, sir. Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
It is a pleasure. And today you want to talk to us about music production.
Yeah. Let's talk about my favorite pastime. Actually, yeah, it was, I can't say it was my first hobby, but it was definitely one that was with me at an early age, mainly because I grew up in a musical family. My family is originally from Detroit. And, you know, this is at the height of the Motown era. So my parents knew a lot of the acts that were recording at Motown. In fact, my grandmother used to babysit a lot of the kids who, you know, for the acts when they would go out on tour and things like that. To me, it was just other people that I was around. Never knew that there were all these celebrities or anything like that, which was really cool because I got to see the human side of the music industry before I got to see like the grimy side of the music industry and things like that. But yeah, growing up in that, I was around instruments all the time, going to my grandmother's house, and my uncle and his band would be practicing down in the basement. He was a studio bass guitarist for several acts around Detroit and in Motown sound. Later, he went out to LA, was working, I believe, with I think it was Capitol Records or something like that. He was still doing studio bass guitar. And so he's a session guitarist. You know, I was just always surrounded by music. My mother used to put me to sleep playing this classical guitar that she had. It was a nylon string. Even to this day, I am very partial to nylon strings, just the softness of how they feel and the warmth from the wood as the guitarist plucks. But yeah, my mom would sing me to sleep playing classical guitar. You know, there was a time where I didn't think that I was going to get into music. I wanted to do other things. I was into art and stuff like that. Grew up the only child for 10 years. And so to keep myself busy, I was into a lot of different hobbies, a lot of things. But music just, even when I tried to get away from it, it would somehow find its way back to me. It wasn't until senior year in high school that it really kicked in. I've been dabbling with music off and on. I would play the piano and stuff like that at school. My parents couldn't afford to actually buy me a piano or anything like that at home. So the only time I had access to it was when I was either at church or I was in school. I had like a couple of hours free time in high school where you could either go away and do work study, stuff like that. I had like 3 hours in high school because I already had a lot of the credits that I needed to graduate. So starting junior year, it was Mr. Carey and Mr. Wagner. They approached me and were like, we see you around here, you know, like on the piano and things like that. Do you know we have a studio? And I was like, say what? You have a what? It's like, we have a studio. So in M Hall, in my high school, man, I had walked down this hallway, I don't know how many times, and had passed this room where the lights were always out. You just never paid it any mind because, I mean, the room was so dark that you could not see what was in there. It was the strangest piece of glass. It wasn't tinted or anything like that. It was just a dark room. Man, Mr. Wagner pulled out these keys that looked like they weighed a ton. And he unlocked this door and turned on this light. And we had a full-on recording studio in our school that no one was using. And he looked at me and he said, you know what? You have time. I will give you a key. Come down here as often as you want. Say less. I got this. Every day, every school day, I should say, from junior year all the way up to senior year, I was in that studio. And at that time, you know, it was the old Macintosh. You remember the old beige square box with the monochromatic screen, the gray and black UI. Yeah, man, I would fire that thing up. Had a full Roland 88-keyed keyboard connected, and that's where I learned about MIDI. That's when I really started getting into music production itself. First saw a software packet that was on it was called Cakewalk. Even to this day, I still use Cakewalk because of that. I'll explain why later, but yeah, man, I started writing and just writing, and the freedom that I had knowing that one, school was taken care of. Like, I was there when my classes were not in session. 3 hours just to do nothing but experiment and make mistakes and erase it and start over and go back at it. Man, I would practice playing the piano so long that my wrist would swell. And then from there, it was taking the sounds that I was creating, mixing together. And I was like, all right, so what's the end game? What do I do with this? So then I started letting people listen to it, which was a big step for me because even to this day, I'm super critical about the stuff that I write, mainly because as soon as you record it, it's recorded and it's out there. So if you put a mistake out there, you're not getting that back. You have released it with that oops inside of it. Sometimes it's a happy oops. Sometimes it's a dang, why did I do that? How did I do that? Oh, that was a mistake. Even when I'm doing a conference talk about accessibility, if I say something wrong, I'm like, oh, I can't pull that back. Well, I can try to smooth it out. But if I have friends in the audience who know that I messed up, then I got to worry about them jokers heckling. Yeah, I started inviting people in into the studio there at school to listen. And next thing you know, folks was literally coming by, like other kids who were interested in music were coming by and they had ideas. Yeah, a lot of cats was coming through. They wanted to rap. All right, cool, easy. I got a drum machine right here. I got a 909. I got this Roland right here. Let's go. So I'm in there making beats, cats rapping. Girls will come through. They want to sing. All right. So now we're working on R&B joints or whatever, you know, and it was amazing. And then I remember Mr. Lord. Mr. Lord was in charge of the theater at our school. He came by and he said, you're making a whole lot of noise with this. And when he said that, I remember thinking, oh, crap, is the music too loud? No, what he meant was, a lot of people are talking about you being in the studio and it's making an impact. So really, because, you know, it's like people knew me, but I still kind of stayed low key, you know, so I didn't think people were really talking about it because nobody really approached me a whole lot with it outside of the time that I was in that hall. And he was like, we're doing a production of Fame. How would you feel about writing some original pieces for it? I was like, huh? Never crossed my mind. That never crossed my mind. Here was, I was just in there having fun because I like to produce and write these songs, but I never actually thought, again, like I said, I never thought, well, like, what was the end game? How was I going to apply this stuff? And so, yeah, I jumped at it. I said, you know what? Let's go. I will do that. I learned that I didn't want to read the script. I was already very familiar with the play of Fame, the movie, and the TV show that used to come out, because me and my parents, we used to watch that. We would have dance and music and everything all in the house. So I knew about Fame. And I remember telling my parents, hey, they just asked me to write the score for the school's production of Fame. And my mom was like, that's amazing. My dad was like, are you ready? I'm like, I have no idea. So I went to a couple of their rehearsals just to kind of get a feel for what it was that they were going to be doing. And I remember speaking with Mr. Lord and Mr. Wagner about the scenes that they wanted me to write for. I realized then I didn't want to know the scenes word for word. I wanted to understand what the scene was supposed to do on an emotional level, what was supposed to happen to the characters, because that's how I would compose. And as dynamic as that show is, I wrote things that were classical with strings. I had some of my friends who were in orchestra come in. I was like, critique this string arrangement for me. To me, it sounds great. To you, a true violinist, like one of my good friends in high school, Derek Reeves, dude was first chair violin for as long as I've known him. Just savate with a violin. It's nasty when you listen to him play. It's like, dude, that's not human. Stop. He came in and he would listen to it. And you're like, I like where you're going, I like this. And he would give me pointers on how to make my violin sound realistic. This is me playing on a keyboard, you know? Another friend of mine, dope pianist, Kevin Anker, one of the most humble musicians I've ever met. Kevin was the type of cat, he'd sit down at a piano and just bend it to his will. He was also a very imposing type of dude. So imagine in high school, somebody that's already standing like 6'6", you know, he was a big dude, big long hair and everything like that. And I remember him coming in, he was listening to one of the piano arrangements that I'd done. And he was like, you know what? You play like Ramsey Lewis. I've never heard that before. I know who Ramsey Lewis is. We have his music in the house. He was like, the way you, he said, your chord progressions, your fingering, he said, you play like Ramsey. I was like, word. Never paid any attention to that. And I remember taking that comment back and talking to my parents about it. And my mom said, that's funny. And I said, why? She goes, because when I was pregnant with you, I used to put the headphones to my belly and I would play Miles Davis and Ramsey Lewis. Can you take a guess at who my two favorite jazz musicians are? So I'm like, okay, apparently I was listening. My first time writing a score for a production, even though it was a high school production, was a big success. Every night someone came up to me and told me that that score was amazing because we had the regular songs, you know, that go with fame. But my music was literally score. I underscored the whole thing. And then that started me down this path. It was like, I know I'm planning to go to school for architecture, but maybe there is something for me in music. Then when I got to college, they had just opened up a media lab. And I was like, oh, nice. I walked in. I remember meeting the director and the professor that were setting up the lab. I started talking to them about, you know, the system, the setup that they had. Turns out they were using Cakewalk. But fast forward now, the computer screens have color. They weren't the Macintoshes anymore. Now we have, you know, the PCs in there. We had Roland U20s and Korg M1s. And I remember sitting down, like, first day, they're explaining to everybody how everything works. And then he comes over to me and I've already written a song. You already know this stuff? I said, yeah, we had a studio in high school and I had this setup. I had a setup similar to this in high school. Next thing you know, I got a job teaching others how to play music and engineer in the media lab. So I did that for 2 years. Then word got out, Homer does all this, and that transitioned into me working at a studio that was in the back of a record store and working at a studio that was downtown. Going there for my sessions and help whoever was coming in to record at that time. I was their studio engineer. I was their producer. I was their session pianist. Whatever role it was, that's just what I filled. But for the most part, I was the engineer behind the board, helping them bring their sound to life. What I quickly realized was my workflow in the studio was that I could get the same sound in that small little phone booth of a studio behind the record store that I could get in the larger studio that I was working in. The vocal room could hold an orchestra, but yet I was able to, if I produced a song over there or produced a song over at the record store, you could not tell which studio I did it in. And that's when people started to take notice. And I started to get a little bit more popular around the city. So now I'm really doing work. Ended up teaming up with some friends of mine. We were doing hip hop at the time. Started off with a group called 11th Hour. Did that for a number of years. And that was kind of like the first time that I ever signed a real deal. Now, mind you, I'm still in school. All this is paying for school right now. And then after that group disbanded, ended up going with joining another group with some friends, and we were called Super Team. Reason being, it was 9 of us. We were deep, and, you know, we would perform from Chicago down to Kentucky, Indiana, up to Michigan, did some shows in Ohio. You know, we performed around the Midwest, different universities, different venues, different under 21 clubs. And then when we all were old enough, you know, over 21 clubs. It was an amazing journey. And during all that time, I really, really got focused on mixing and mastering and getting into the technology and understanding how it worked. But at the same time, you know, you also had to be on your P's and Q's. So I was learning about the business side of things. Well, it turns out that the guys who own the record store with the studio back, they were in law school. So I would pick their brain about the music business from a legal perspective. What do I need to do to make sure that I'm good? Learned about copyrights, even down to if you are thinking about starting your own business and things like that, if you need to do trademarks, what do you do with that? Cool. So I started taking what I was learning from them and my friends who were writing music and producing and all that. I started telling them about it. Because like, look, these are some pitfalls that I learned about. You definitely need to know about them as well if you plan on doing anything serious, remotely serious with this. It turned into me helping folks in the studio, not just being there to push buttons and slide faders up and down to make sure that they sounded good. I was hot and heavy with that all the way up until our group disbanded in 2000. I had a home studio, everything, because I also realized it was cheaper to have a studio at the house than to have to actually go into studios. Now, granted, while I was working there, I had free studio time. Easy. Let's go. But when I wasn't working there anymore, oh, studio hours added up. And being fresh out of college, that was expensive. You know, everybody starts off with that entry-level job. Your rent was low then, but everything was low at that time. I saved my little money, and I remember building my studio at home. Now, by this time, I live in Florida. You know, I'm working, making adult money, so I'm able to build my studio so that I could get that same sound in that larger studio. And it's just me doing digital production, things like that. But I'm still being shoulder tapped to write jingles or score someone's independent film. Did a lot of those, even before IMDb was a thing. All that changed in 2003. I was gone, went out of town. And when I got back home, the only thing in my studio was my desk. Everything in my studio was gone. Music that I had written that I didn't think was good enough to release, just sitting on hard drives doing nothing. 17 years worth of work, 17 years worth of time away from family and other commitments to make sure that I was doing what Thelonious Sphere Monk said, which was fill in the missing note. Gone. It took me 5 months just to rebuild my PC, just to even go out and just build a new one. I've always been in tech. First PC I ever had was one, honestly, first PC I ever had was a friend of mine, Yuri Lee. We call him Paragraph. He was one of the members of Super Team right along with me. He was out at a garage sale and he said, "Hey, Monk," that's what everybody called me, Monk, because I played piano. It was a nod to Thelonious Sphere, Monk, the jazz pianist. So everybody, even to this day, I'm still known as Monk. He was like, "This person is getting rid of this computer up here, and I know you do computers. You want me to grab it for you?" I was like, "Yeah, how much?" He was like, "20. I said, "Say less, get it." So he brought me this computer and I was like, "Nice." And here it is. You know, I got it at the house getting it set up. And I realized that the applications that I wanted to run, the graphics card was not keeping up. The memory wasn't keeping up. So I said, "You know what? Let me upgrade this." Well, what I did not know was that this Packer had proprietary parts. And so when I started to tinker around in this thing, it was like, "Oh, crud. This doesn't just use any old off-the-shelf type of parts. I actually have to get in touch with them to be able to rebuild this thing." So I was like, "I'm not doing that." So that's what started me building my own PCs. So I built my workstation. Like I said, after 5 months, had it back up and going. This whole time, I've been, you know, working in web. Started building websites in 94. I was a therapist up until that point. But when I was working on a jingle with this one guy, was at his studio, his home studio was freaking amazing. Oh my gosh, his whole basement was just kitted out. It was a musician's playground. I remember going down there and talking with him. He was like, "You're into computers, right?" I said, "Yeah." He goes, "I got to show you some." And he pulls out this CD and he sticks it in. Okay, nothing fancy there. I'm thinking we're about to listen to music. And on his computer screen pops up his information and it's all animated. And I hear music playing with it. And I'm like, hold up. This isn't just regular old HTML. What in the world is this? He goes, nah, man, it's this new technology, something like Flash or something, Direct or something like that. I was like, hold up. So now the geek in me is mad curious. We done completely forgot about this jingle that we're supposed to be writing for this company. Now we're geeking out about this CD. So I'm watching, you know, this animation on the screen. And me being a nerd, I click on the CD and open it up because I want to see what this executable looks like. And I see that this executable has a very familiar logo on it. It was a Director file. I said, oh, how much did you pay for this? He goes, you might want to sit down. This brother paid $75 a minute to have a company produce this CD for him. This interactive business card. Here's where I started to make that transition. Because I was in school, they were giving this software away. You could literally go down to the bookstore and be like, yeah, can I get the Macromedia Suite? And they were like, here you go. It's a part of your tuition. I had the entire Macromedia Suite sitting on my desk collecting dust. Still in shrink wrap. That night after we finished writing that jingle, I went back home. I opened up that software and I loaded up Director. That was like, if somebody's paying $75 a minute for this stuff, I have it here and all I have is time and opportunity. Let's go. I'm going to do this. So that's how I ended up teaching myself how to build Flash applications. I was already building web applications, you know, using HTML and designing everything using Photoshop and stuff like that. But it was just like, that's how I got into the website. Then I realized, oh man, I could take the music that I'm writing and add it in here as well as audio tracks. So now everything that I absolutely have a passion for is coming together in one place.
I'm curious to know, you've been doing this for, you know, for years, producing music. How have you as a producer evolved from those first days? I mean, just starting and producing music for other people. Has your approach changed to how you help someone else find the sound of their music and bring it to life?
It has definitely changed. Working with the number of groups, working with the number of people that I had in the studio, which during the summertime, it seemed like everybody and their mom wanted to release something, right? So I had all kinds of different people coming through, different levels of talent, different ears. A lot of them were repeat customers because we were either working on a demo tape for them or we were actually putting together, you know, a full project. You know, we were doing mixtapes, demo tapes, full projects, getting music ready for them to actually do shows, live performances, but they needed to have the music pre-recorded in the event that whoever, whatever, just didn't work out. I got to know everyone that I was working with so well that I could tell when their breathing would be off, even before they got to the point to where their breath would run out. That's when I started to get picky about music. And I remember my dad asking me one day, he goes, do you find that you don't enjoy music anymore now that you know how it's put together? I said, no, it's just the opposite. I actually enjoy music because I know how it's put together. It's like when I hear something familiar, I'm like, oh yeah, I know what sound bank that came from. I have that sound. But it got to the point to where it was like, I know what I like and I know what I don't like. I know how something fits well together versus something that's just like, nah, don't try doing that. And so my advice for any of the artists that I was working with would be very tailored to them and their performance and their feel, because I got to know what their sound was. And so if they were coming in, wanted to introduce something that would clash with that, I was able to steer them away. And then also by being a sound engineer, it's like when you take something straight off the shelf and use it versus you take it off the shelf and then you twist it and you mold it, you use it as a template, but then you change it into something that actually better suits their personality, their vocal style, things like that. That's what I would end up doing. Even modern times now, I still have people come to me and ask me, you know, they call me OG, what kind of advice do you have? And I find now these days that I have to go back to what the lawyers taught me, because a lot of cats coming up, they're not paying attention to the legal side of releasing music. There's so many people that I've come across when I've asked them, do you have your stuff copywritten? They're like, no. I'm like, so you just released your music without getting it copywritten? They're like, yeah. I'm like, okay, cool. Do you have any ISRC numbers? What's that? Do you have any barcodes? Yeah, we have barcodes. Okay, but you don't have an ISRC number. No. Why not? And then I have to educate them, because what a lot of people don't realize is that you have metadata that gets applied to your music in this digital age, and that's how things get tracked. And if you don't have that metadata embedded in your music, folks can't find you. We can stream it all day long, but the companies like Harry Fox and all the other companies, performing rights organizations who have to track this music, Sound Exchange, all these different companies who track where all this music is being played, you're not going to get your royalties from it. That's a huge gap that I have seen in, you know, since streaming has really become a thing. So my advice for young artists, aspiring artists, even old hats at it who just aren't paying attention, it's like, yeah, you may be involved with the music side. You may be a wonderful musician, but you also need to protect yourself on the business side. You need to make sure that you have your stuff copyrighted, because the moment you release something like Homer Gaines did, and you hear somebody else playing it, you have nothing to fall back on. You can't go out there and be like, but that's my track. The court's going to be like, show me the documentation. Show me the proof that it's yours. You know, you could do the poor man's copyright where you would end up mailing a copy to yourself. Nah, let's send it off. Copyright.gov, pay your fee and get it done correctly. You know, a lot of people come to me and they already have their styles baked and whatnot. And I'm like, I'm fine. But how are you from the admin side of your craft? So that seems to be the gap that I've been helping people fill as of late.
You've produced your own music. You've produced music for others. Is there a difference for you when you produce your own stuff versus other people? Do you approach it differently?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. When I approach my stuff, it's my baby. I learned a long time ago with music production and even with web design, I cannot care more about your product than you do. Because there was a time where I did, because I love the work that I do. And when I see somebody kind of half-stepping with it, I'm like, nah, you got to step your game up. Let's go. I need you to keep up with me. And we had this joke. We had this joke in the school of psychology. Say, how many psychologists does it take to change a light bulb? The answer was one, but the light bulb has to want to change. Same thing with music, same thing with web design. I can give you all the professional advice in the world. If you do not want to take it, cool. You don't want to take it. Guess what? I still have a job that I have to complete. You know, I've had knuckleheads come into the studio where I've told them, get in there, do your verse, because they were playing around. At some point in time, my dad voice comes out. People would laugh at me. They'd be like, uh-oh, mom been turned into somebody's father. The dad voice would come out, because being in the studio was time. Being in the studio was money. Yes, I'm being paid for this, but this is money that you are spending. Stop. You're supposed to be here doing what you're supposed to be doing, not partying and whatnot. We got work to do. It got to the point, man, like, for instance, that one group, I had to tell this one cat, stop touching buttons. He just would not listen. And I believe that was the very moment where I learned to let go. Said, you know what? I'm engineering. In the process of mastering, I was mastering their project. Jack Wagon goes over to the side of the room where the keyboards were and started playing the keyboards. Bruh, didn't I tell you not to touch anything? Because at that time, everything was coming back live. If I had turned down the keyboards, you would not have been able to hear it in the recording, because the MIDI was playing back. So everything was coming back live. All his other boys understood that. He didn't. Oh, can we go back and change it? No, because you're already 2 hours over time because y'all shenanigans. And I got other folks that need to come in here. Now, with me, my stuff, it's my baby. I will take forever and 3 years to record something sometimes. You know, I started recording a project last year. Got busy with conference talks and family and everything. Do you know that I forgot that I even wrote those songs? I went back in and looked up. I was like, what's this folder? And I opened it up. I'm like, oh, I released one track off of there, and it's called Sidewalks. I released it as a single because the rest of it, that one was going to be titled Parkour Clouds. I still have it. I still have to release it. But I find like I will take time. There are moments where I can sit down and just write a song. and everything just flows. And then there are other days where I will needle at it to the point to where I mess it up and then I just scrap the whole thing. You know, you can overdo stuff. It's like when you're cooking, you can overseason something. Why do I have all these effects on this sound? What am I doing? Why is all this clashing? Just because I added all this stuff thinking that it was going to sound good at that moment. But then when the whole thing came together, it's not a colorful rainbow of something beautiful. It is a muddy mess. So then I have to start removing things, step back away from it, change it up even. I don't have that luxury with someone else's time and their money, studio. So that's the difference for me with when it comes to production and working on my own stuff.
When you do work on your own stuff, is there a separation between Homer the musician and Homer the engineer? Or is it all the same thing?
Yeah, man. All right. So that has been something that I struggle with even to this day. Graf, who I mentioned earlier, Yuri, he was over here at the house last month. I was letting him listen to some stuff that I'm working on. And he was like, that's that monk sound. I was like, what do you mean? He was like, you just have this sound. And it's always been there. You switch it up, but whenever I hear your music, whether it's playing, you know, in the car or if I'm out and I hear it someplace, I know it's you because you just have this distinct thumbprint. And he called it the shake well sound because I like to use, even though I'm a digital recorder or a digital artist, I like to use sounds that are organic. So he was like, you have these shakers and you have this particular cadence in the way that your shakers are recorded. It's like there are times where I can sit here and I'm playing and that emotional side comes out from me playing and it starts to be a groove and I just start to lay the bed, the beat, the bass. There's a formula to it. And then the engineer comes out when I realize that I'm being too formulaic and I want to change it up. When I'm writing my music, the moment that I start to name the tracks, because up until then, the tracks are just track one, track two, track three, track four. You know, you don't know what instrument it is. But it's not until I actually start naming it that the song actually starts to become real to me. Then that engineer comes out and I start needling it. What do I want here? What is this supposed to sound like? Is this a lo-fi track? All right, if it's a lo-fi track, where am I going with this? Where do I want the person to be with this? If it's not a lo-fi track, am I getting the transients right? Is my high end, is it too sharp? Where in the world did that snare come from? Is way too loud. And, you know, and I have to take a break. You know, these headphones that I have, I mix in open back headphones so that, you know, the bass can escape. I get that close to it. And then there are times where I realize the really picky engineer is coming out and you're forgetting what the music was about. Because I can over-engineer something. And when you over-engineer it, again, it goes back to cooking. You can over-season something. I can do the exact same thing over-engineering. As an artist, yeah, I can do too many layers, you know? But even as an engineer, I can tweak until the original sound of the song is no longer what it was supposed to be, you know? So I have to be very cognizant of that. And often it will delay me because it'll kill the vibe. I'm not feeling this track anymore. Like when I was telling you how I lost everything, got married after dating for 5.5 years. Now it's 2016. So Christmas of 2016. My wife, Tammy, surprises me with a new Roland keyboard. Now, mind you, from 2003 up to 2016, I didn't write music. I didn't even go into studios, nothing. I had nothing to do with music. I would listen to it, but that was it. She buys my keyboard or gives me the keyboard for Christmas and says, it's time for you to start playing again. What I told myself was, I'm no longer going to be that picky about what I write and just hold on to it, you know, just hoard it for myself because thinking that it's never done. Because I've heard music out there that where, like, if it's music that I don't enjoy, I will tear it apart. But if it's something that I absolutely can get behind, regardless of the genre, I'm all in it. You know, as an artist, I'm in it, listening to it. Just, I can't believe that they did that type of chord progression and it actually worked. It was gorgeous. But if I don't like it, oh, it's, why did you do that sound? Why'd you put that reverb there? Why'd you, you know, it gets like that. And I told myself, I said, whatever I write, I'm going to release. So 2017, I released my first solo project, made that decision rather to just become an independent artist. You know, people have asked me, would you ever sign to a record label or whatnot? I'm like, nah, been there, done that. Don't like it. I'm just going to do me. Friend of mine back in college, he said, I write do it to it music. And I looked at him with a cross face because I'm like, what do you mean do it to it music? I wasn't sure where he was going with that. He said, you write do it to it music. I said, what do you mean? He goes, you write music that you can do anything to. Study to, clean the house to, wash dishes to, drive to, chill to, whatever. So I was like, oh, I write background music. Okay, got it. And then Graf even told me that. He said, you write for the listener. Like, I promote my music, but I don't actively promote it like artists who are on labels. A lot of my stuff is found organically, which is cool. I had a really blessed year when a local DJ here heard some of my stuff and was spinning it for the entire year on her program. Everything I released, she was like, send it over. I was like, okay. So my listeners really blew up then, which was cool. To the point to where I was in an airport and somebody recognized me. I wasn't ready for that either. That kind of caught me off guard. The engineer I have to put aside and just lean into the musician and embrace what I release, knowing that there was a purpose for me to release it. I'm not going to say that I don't have songs right now on my hard drive that haven't been released I haven't released everything. Some stuff still needs to be cooked. It's just an idea. At least this time, the ideas are actually getting out, making it to where they're supposed to be, which is to whomever's listening.
Homer, where can people find you?
Nowhere. Don't come looking for me at all. No. A lot of people online know me as Circle Box, you know, XIRCLEBOX. You can find me on Blue Sky, the name. Homer Gaines, you can find me on LinkedIn. Those are pretty much the only spaces where I'm occupying right now. Or if you are into tech, which a lot of us are, you see that I'm speaking about accessibility at somebody's conference, come through, say what's up, say hi. Or if you just need some music to chill to, pull me up on YouTube or any major streaming service that you use because I stream worldwide.
That's awesome. I feel like we could be talking for hours.
Yeah, I just noticed that. My bad.
Not at all. Thank you so much for chatting with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, man. I really appreciate it. It's great talking with you.
This is all for this episode of Design Downtime. Thank you for joining me. And until next time, I hope you enjoy your downtime.